Bob and his fellow critics may be giving The Happening the cold shoulder, but the movie is part of a hot trend, the environmental fright flick. NPR's Netta Ulaby takes a look at the latest in eco-horror.
All those deaths in New York and Philadelphia forced The Happening's heroes to join a mass evacuation.
You okay?
I see Boston got hit, too.
Where'd you hear that?
A friend from work. What about Yvette?
Oh, she made it out on the bus.
What the hell is going on, Elliot?
What's happening is an environmental catastrophe. Director M. Night Shyamalan originally called the movie The Green Effect.
Because when I was writing it and I sold it, I hadn't seen Inconvenient Truth yet. And when I saw that, I was like, oh man, this is worse than I thought.
Shyamalan joked that Al Gore's documentary may be the seminal horror film of the century. And in Inconvenient Truth's box office success may be partially responsible for the recent flood of apocalyptic dramas about climate change. Within the past few years, we've had Sunshine, The Day After Tomorrow, and even a CBS miniseries about global warming that had hurricanes sweeping through Chicago and tornadoes tearing through Vegas. Expect remakes soon of movies like The Swarm and Creature from the Black Lagoon that blame pollution and climate change for monstrous mutants. Next year, the science fiction epic Avatar, directed by James Cameron, will depict aliens and humans struggling for ecological survival. Film scholar Kendall Phillips says these movies all have one idea in common.
Somehow the planet has grown tired of us, and we've overstayed our welcome, and something bad is about to happen.
Environmental horror pictures are nothing new. Think Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster from 1971. Phillips says eco-horror was common in the 70s, when moviegoers escaped worries about a gas crisis, with disaster films like Earthquake, and movies about mutant frogs, alligators, and bears. Horror always seems to reflect the anxieties of its time, says scholar Kendall Phillips. But unlike the creature features of the past, today's eco-horror movies, like The Happening, see the whole world as malevolent and vengeful.
I'm scared.
It's not that far a stretch from the old haunted house movies in which the house becomes kind of a character. So if you think of the Amityville Horror, now we're just expanding that so that literally the ecosphere plays that kind of menacing role.
Wow, our planet is the haunted house.
The sad truth is that the world is going to become a more and more desperate place. It's going to look more and more like a zombie film as we go along.
Independent filmmaker Larry Fessenden.
That's why I make horror films. I'm trying to say, wake up, people.
Fessenden has been making environmentally themed horror films for years. Animal testing or oil drilling are, to him, ideal subjects for the genre.
I can think of nothing more horrifying than the self-betrayal of destroying the very thing that you love, the very thing that nurtures you. And rather than make films about people killing their mothers, I make films about our sort of indescribable self-contempt that we would destroy the earth that gives us life.
Why wouldn't the wilderness fight us, like any organism would fend off a virus?
The Last Winter is a Fessenden film that takes place in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. It's set in the near future, and the government has just granted oil company workers permission to drill.
Ever since I got here, I could tell that there was something wrong. Not the job, not the cold, not being isolated. I'm telling you, I've seen something out there in the snow.
Oil is literally the crushed plant and animal life from millennia ago, and now we're burning that. We're burning these corpses, and naturally that suggests sort of a ghostly return, and we're desecrating graves.
Larry Fessenden is now in talks with Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. DiCaprio last year produced a scary environmental documentary of his own, The 11th Hour. Hollywood has a long way to go when it comes to its own environmentalism, says Fessenden. Film sets leave massive carbon footprints. But he hopes that eco-horror can affect the cultural conversation.
We don't want to be in a horror film. We don't want to wake up in a horrible superstorm. We don't want to have wars over the last drops of water. We don't want our shores inundated with environmental refugees. These are all potentially on our horizon. we don't want to live in a horror film. We want to go to them at the movies and then come out and have a sweet and beautiful life.
After all, Fessenden says, what is a horror film but a cautionary tale? Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
You can find reviews of all kinds of summer movies, from horror comedy to a Czech farce to a Werner Herzog documentary, on our website, npr.org. Now to a game with a brutal edge. It's called Mixed Martial Arts, or MMA. There's punching, kicking, grappling, choking. Bouts take place inside a chain-linked octagon called The Cage. Despite the brutality, the sport is popular. CBS has just started airing fights in prime time. Reporter Nancy Mullane has this profile of one top MMA fighter and part-time ambassador for the sport, Jake Shields.
Jake Shields doesn't look dangerous. If you saw him on a street corner, you probably wouldn't take much notice. But inside the padded gym where he trains, this medium-height, lean, white guy with a bouncy walk is treated like a world-class superstar. Shields says it's all about kicks, punches, takedowns, and chokeholds.
The chokes, I'll choke the guy's unconscious because it's like, that's not going to hurt him, he'll just wake up. But the arms, you know, the knees, I mean, a few years ago I broke some arms and knees and stuff, but I'm mellower now and I try not to.
After years of being hit and rubbed against the mats, his ears have turned into hard masses of scar tissue. They call them cauliflower ears. He straps on a padded helmet, something not allowed in competition. Then Shields and his sparring partner, Javier McKay, jump through the ropes. McKay says even though there's no eye gouging, biting, or breaking single fingers, sparring with Shields is a total workout.
It's a strong force coming at me, and I gotta be in shape to deal with that appropriately. Otherwise, like, I could go home with some injuries or some head damage. So
they can't just hop in and spar. Some people think they can, but they get in not in shape. I mean, 1 minute in, I'll have guys getting out of the ring puking and stuff.
After 4 8-minute rounds, blood is oozing out of Shields' nose. He wipes it away and gets back in the ring for 2 more rounds. Mike Fazzino is owner of the Freestyle Submission Academy.
He has a lot of fire. He just has that in him, that winning spirit, so it's really hard to beat him. But he figured he'd train with guys that are best in the world.
When Shields isn't training or fighting, he lives in a top-floor flat in San Francisco with 2 other MMA fighters.
The house is a mess, so 3 guys living here. Fighter house. The downstairs is the worst.
Vitamin drinks, eggs, cheese, and tortillas fill the refrigerator. Shields is a lifelong vegetarian. The living room is bare except for 2 big comfy couches and a giant flat-screen TV.
Not too decorated up, just got the TV, watch a little TV, hang out on the couch.
Shields says his love for fighting began at the end of a long dirt road in the California foothills. That's where he grew up with his 2 older brothers, his father and mother, Billy Shields.
So they had like a lot of time and a lot of space where they just got to run around and be kids and do creative play and raise them to be really more independent-minded.
Jake Shields says most of that creative play was really learning how to survive his 2 brothers.
They used to beat the crap out of me. I guess that made me mean. Not mean, but I needed some payback.
Payback began at the age of 9 when he started competing as an amateur wrestler. In college, he discovered the world of MMA.
There's hundreds of martial arts out there. There's karate, kung fu, taekwondo, anything. But really, the arts that seem to be the most successful are wrestling, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, boxing and kickboxing, like all mixed together.
Now, Shields is the MMA poster boy. He was recruited to conduct interviews for the first network broadcast of a primetime MMA fight.
I'm Jake Shields of ProLee.com. I'm here with Jake.
When an MMA fight's on TV and he's not working, Shields and his friends get in front of his flat screen to study the competition.
Look how good his footwork is, Machida.
Yeah.
He stays out of range. That's why he never gets hit. That's why he's hard to take down, too, because he moves back and forth and crosses his feet so well. All right, they need to start fighting.
Watching the fight, Shields gets a hungry look in his eyes. He'll have to wait to get back in the ring. His championship MMA battle for the welterweight title is coming up this fall. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Mullane in San Francisco.
Yesterday, the pioneer woman helped to win a continent. Today, with the same spirit of determination, American women are working to save this way of life.
Katharine Hepburn in a film reel during the build-up to World War II. For the first time, women were taking a central role in the nation's defense. Rosies, they were called, for Rosie the Riveter. Thousands of workers crawl over the mammoth hulls of Navy ships in dry dock. Women in work overalls, their hair wrapped up in cloth, wield drills, hammers, welding torches. They're outfitting these battleships at a breakneck pace, not a day lost, sending hundreds of ships to the war in the Pacific. This was the scene, 65 years ago, at the shipyards of Richmond, California, just north of Oakland. Today, there's a national park here dedicated to these workers.
I'm standing in Shipyard 3. We can see San Francisco across the bay, but right in front of us is a humongous victory ship. This is a cargo ship. It's called the Red Oak Victory. It's gray. It's longer than a football field and several stories tall. It's docked here in Shipyard 3.
What I welded was like over here.
Show me.
See, this is called a bulkhead.
Agnes Moore is 88 years old, neck scarf, wavy brown hair. You would never believe this elegant woman was a welder. She points to a line of gray metal along a seam of the red oak.
See the little ridges where you had to oscillate it all the time as you went on up? And then where your rod ended, it always left a bulge like that.
And you can tell where someone pulled out a new rod.
Yeah.
The Richmond shipyards were a war-building machine in the 1940s. They churned out 747 ships, more than any other U.S. builder during World War II. At the height of production, almost a third of the workers were women.
My name is Marion Nguyen. When I worked here, it was Marion Parsons, and we worked on West Storage, which is a little area just for us, pipe welders.
Nguyen was among the oldest of 11 children. One of her brothers was killed in the war. She came to California from Minnesota.
I wanted to go someplace because we lived in out in the country, and it was a small town, and there wasn't that much to do. You couldn't get a good job, and this was an offer of a good job.
Another part of the national park, a quiet, grassy hill, looks out over the bay. Canada geese fly north. Park Ranger Elizabeth Tucker describes Richmond before America entered the war. There was not a single shipyard here.
So they actually started building the shipyards here in 1940 and building the ships at the same time while they were constructing the shipyard. Of course, when Pearl Harbor happened, a lot more money poured into Richmond. So each year, these shipyards and Richmond itself just kept getting bigger and bigger. So the city of Richmond went from about 24,000 people prior to the war to over 100,000 people.
From every part of the country, people made for Richmond. It was hard work, but they were good-paying jobs, especially for women. Recruitment ads went out from newspapers, televisions, radios.
Friends, it would be impossible for me or for anyone else to overemphasize the importance of women in this war. But even more of us women are needed.
Thank you, Kate Smith.
Agnes Moore was 21 when she heard an ad like that one.
I got all dressed up in my best. You know, I was going to apply for this important job, and I walked in. The receptionist said, well, you know, we have a lot of openings in the office. I said, no, I want to be a welder. That's an important job, and that's what I want to do.
That's why this is the right place for the Rosie the Riveter Memorial. The National Park's Director of Interpretation is Naomi Torres. She and Park Ranger Tucker lead me to the centerpiece of the park, an enormous metal sculpture jutting up from the ground.
Let's walk through this. What is this thing we're seeing here? This looks like the hull of a ship flipped over so that the keel is up in the air.
That's right, and it is upside down because that's how the ships were built, or at least assembled.
And right over here is a really interesting thing. Women workers were highly valued because they were smaller. And here's an example of a kind of crawl space they would have had to go through to get into the double bottoms of the ship and do all their welding.
So you're, right now, Naomi Torres is in a tiny little space in there. Would they have had to get into that little space through this 2x1 foot little portal here?
Yes, they would have. I'm about 5'2", and it's still kind of small. And imagine being in here with a welding torch or something like that. I mean, it was really tiny. And this was before all of the safety.
Right, there was no OSHA.
There was no OSHA that existed, and so there were small spaces. There's oral histories we received where they had to go on the sides of the ship, and people were held by their ankles, hanging upside down, welding without any kind of safety measures.
Agnes Moore remembers the dangers of welding ships all day long, especially when she had to weld parts up above her head on the ceiling.
It was hard to keep the metal up there where it belonged.
You had hot slag dripping on your
eyeball. Oh, yeah, hot metal coming down. It would hit your neck and go right around your shirt collar, which you had everything as tight as you could, but it would still get inside your clothing and burn. So, all of us expected that. It just went with the job.
It's stories like this that make the memorial so inspiring, says the park's Naomi Torres.
What people know about is the war. But once you peel back that outer layer, there's all that support that was required to help win the war. And that was what happened here in the home front. And the memorial is about the only thing that remains that recognizes that part of that history.
After the war, most Rosies went back to conventional work, school teachers or homemakers. Coming to this new memorial reminds Agnes Moore not of the hard labor, but of the sense of purpose they felt.
I'm glad that I was able to do something, and I have been told by a Navy man, I want to thank you for saving my life. Well, that took my breath away, and then he went on to explain that he was in Guadalcanal, and he said that their supplies were running low. They didn't have anything to fight the battle with. They knew the Japanese were over on the other side of the mountain, and they thought they were just going to walk right over them. And he said they got up one morning, and they looked out on the water, and he said there was every kind of a ship you could imagine, as far as you could see, just ships everywhere. And he said, we knew then that we were going to make it. And that just really... The idea that he would thank me when he was risking his life. I didn't risk anything. The men that went over there and fought the battles, they're the heroes. I don't consider myself a hero. I just was glad that I could do something that really needed to be done. And everybody else felt the same way. That's just the way we were.
Agnes Moore says she misses that common purpose. She does not miss hot metal dripping from her welding rod, though she can still tell a good weld from a botched one, and she'll show you. Her story and those of other Rosies are archived at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond, California.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Cohen. Madeline, you were just asking me if you should get the new iPhone.
I was, just before the show, just wondering, well, it's new, it's cheaper, maybe.
It's pretty swell. Now, you've got the BlackBerry, right?
Yeah, I have a BlackBerry.
But you're not totally in love with it, maybe?
Well, I think we have a platonic relationship.
Well, you know, it is tough figuring out how to design technology that'll make us gals whip out our wallets.
And this week you've been doing a series on this, and today you've been looking at the differences in gender when it comes to gadgets.
Genevieve Bell is a cultural anthropologist for Intel. She's spent a lot of time going into homes and observing how people use technology. Genevieve joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So, does gender really make a difference when it comes to technology?
Of course it does. I mean, gender, as we know, impacts all kinds of things. To understand how men and women use technology differently, I think you have to kind of back it up a little bit and think about how men and women have different, in some ways, lives and demands on their time. If you look at the data from the U.S. Department of Labor, if you look at data from the United Nations, one of the things that's really striking is the ways in which the demands on women's time haven't, in fact, changed in nearly 50 years. We spend as much time now doing housework, child rearing, and emotional work for those around us as we did 50 years ago, and add on to that our presence in paid labor, what you get is women who are really in some ways time constrained. And I think that drives a lot of our demands about technology.
A lot of these gadgets that you see out there geared towards women are pink or covered in jewels or fluffy in some regard. Does any of this actually matter to us as consumers?
I've heard that jokingly referred to as that to sell technology to women, you have to shrink it and pink it, which is terrible. I think in some ways those attempts are heading in the right direction, but they're profoundly misguided. Women, and indeed I would argue many men, know that how they look, how they conduct themselves, how they're dressed, how they're augmented, impacts how people make sense of them. And it's part and parcel of how people know how to read you in the world. And technologies have become part of that ensemble, if you will. I mean, they've become part of how we're made sense of. They're part of our identities, particularly small mobile devices, mobile phones, cameras, MP3 players. I mean, there's a whole constellation of technologies that we carry with us now that have become ways by which people make sense of us.
What's been the biggest surprise to you in all this research that you've done?
Actually, I think the biggest surprise to me came about 3.5 years ago when we were doing some work on early adopters of Wi-Fi technology and wireless technology, and we discovered that women were, in fact, the early adopters. It wasn't men at all. And it was one of the first times I remember looking across the data of technology adoption statistics and technology use statistics where women were, in fact, leading men.
And when you're talking about wireless, you're meaning the ability to access the Internet from a number of locations, right?
Absolutely.
And why would women be more likely to do that?
Well, the data we had suggested that it was about the fact that it meant that you could fit the Internet into a life where you were having to juggle lots of competing demands. So think back to what I said about women being really time-constrained. What wireless internet access let women do was do the family's banking while they were taking kids to the dentist, you know, be at a kid's football game and still be able to take care of shopping. It let people do family communications while also spending time with their kids. And it really kind of fit into a life where there's a lot of multitasking happening. And I think for some of those reasons, women were adopting that technology.
Genevieve Bell is an anthropologist, and she's the director of the User Experience Group at Intel. Thanks so much, Genevieve.
Oh, thank you.